Chapter 6. "They're animals," snarled Menander. The young cataphract had a naturally light complexion. That skin color, along with his tawny hair and blue eyes, was the product of the Gothic blood which flowed through his veins, as did through that of many Thracians. Now his color was not light. It was pure white. From nausea, partly, but mostly, thought Belisarius, from sheer rage. "They're even killing the children. Babies." Unlike Menander, the general's complexion retained its natural olive shade. He could not help hearing the sounds of the massacre even from the distance of a mile. And although, unlike Menander, drawn by horrified curiosity, the general had not gone to witness the butchery of Ranipur, he had no difficulty imagining the scene. He, like his veterans, had seen it before. Seen it more than once, in fact, if never on such a scale. The four Romans were standing in an isolated little group just outside the entrance to the Mawa Emperor's pavilion. His new pavilion, hastily erected during the 4 days while Ranipur was sacked. The sack was almost over now, not from any sudden mercy on the part of the Mawa, but simply because they had already slaughtered almost everyone in the city, even, as Menander said, down to the babes. Today was the 5th day since the Mawa had finally broken through the city's defenses. The successful assault had come the very morning after Belisarius and his men had helped defeat the rebel sally. That sally had been Ranipur's last gasp. "It's our fault," whispered Menander. Belisarius placed a gentle hand on the cataphract's shoulder. "Yes and no, Menander. Even if the rebels had killed the emperor, Ranipur would still have fallen. A few weeks later, perhaps, but Skandagupta's successor would have seen to it." His words obviously brought no relief. Sighing faintly, Belisarius turned the young cataphract to face him. The boy's eyes were downcast. "Look at me, Menander," he commanded. Reluctantly, the cataphract raised his head. Belisarius found it hard not to flinch from the bitter, unspoken reproach in those young eyes. "If there is fault here, Menander, it is mine, not yours. I am your general, and I gave the command." Menander tightened his jaw, looked aside. From behind, Valentinian interjected himself harshly. "That's pure bullshit, sir, if you'll pardon my saying so. You didn't order this." The veteran started to add something, but Belisarius waved him down. "That's not the point, Valentinian. I knew this would happen when I gave the orders I did. Just as I've done before, ordering that a city which won't surrender be stormed by my troops."
"It's still not the same, sir," rumbled Anastasius. "Sure, there have been times you've lost control of your troops during a sack. I don't know a general who hasn't. But you did everything you could to restore discipline as fast as possible, including the execution of soldiers proven guilty of atrocities."
The huge Thracian spat on the ground.
"These Mawa troops aren't out of control. They were ordered to commit atrocities. The Emperor's personal bodyguards have been setting the example."
Another spit.
"Niptide dogs."
Menander shuddered. The gesture seemed to bring some relief. The boy rubbed his face and said quietly, "At least the Rajputs haven't been part of it. I've come to like those men in a way these past weeks. I'd have hated it if..." Valentinian laughed.
"Part of it? Mother of God, I thought there was going to be a civil war yesterday."
Belisarius and Anastasius chuckled. Menander's color suddenly returned. The boy's grin was harsh beyond his years.
"That was something, wasn't it? When the Yetai offered them what was left of the noble women. If Ranasanga hadn't restrained them, I swear the stinking emperor would have needed a new bodyguard."
He straightened up, squared his shoulders. A quick final glance at Ranipur, then, "I'm all right, General." Behind them, from within the Emperor's pavilion, came rolling percussion. Where Romans used cornices to blare for attention, the Mawa used huge kettle drums.
"That's our cue," said Belisarius. "Follow me. And remember, whatever the Mawa do, we're Romans."
The interior of the pavilion was crowded, but the Romans had no difficulty making their way through the mob. The Mawa nobles and officials parted before them courteously. Even the Yetai bodyguards did so, although not without bestowing savage, knowing grins upon them.
"They've got something planned for us, I warrant," muttered Anastasius.
At the center of the pavilion, the Romans found that a special place of honor had been reserved by the Mawa for their foreign guests. A roughly circular space had been cleared, approximately 40 feet in diameter. The space was encircled by soldiers, keeping the general mass of officials, nobles, and bureaucrats at a slight distance. Most of the soldiers consisted of the emperor's Yetai bodyguards, but there was a small group of some 15 Rajputs included in that select company. They stood by themselves, erect and dignified, giving the Yetai to either side not so much as a glance. The emperor himself sat on a throne made of some unfamiliar, beautifully grained hardwood. The carving of the wood was exquisite, what little of it could be seen. Most of the wood was covered with silk upholstering, the rest inlaid with gold, gems, and ivory. Seated around him on chairs, which were less magnificent but still very fine, were his immediate entourage of kinsmen. Menandakatra was prominent among them. Diagonally before him and to his right sat the emperor's chief military officers. There were 8 of them, arranged in 2 rows. All of them were sitting on luxurious cushions in that odd cross-legged position which Indians called the lotus. Belisarius was interested to note that Rana Sanga was now among that group. Lord Harsha was not. Belisarius had heard that the former high commander had been banished to his estate in disgrace. Had he not been related to the emperor by blood, he would probably have been executed. His place had been taken by another of Skandagupta's many cousins, Lord Tathagata. Belisarius subjected the new Malwa high commander to a quick scrutiny. Average height, stout, middle-aged. Beyond that, there was little to discern in the man's lidded eyes and heavy features. He gave Rana Sanga a glance. The Rajput was seated in the 2nd row of officers. He sat erect, his head rising well above those of his fellows. His eyes met those of Belisarius. They seemed like agates, blank, flat, unreadable. To the emperor's left, also diagonally before him, was a place for the foreign emissaries. The Ethiopians were already there. Plush stools upholstered in silk had been provided for the high-ranking outlanders. Prince Aeon and Garmat sat on 2 such stools, with Usanas and the Sawin standing respectfully behind them. A 3rd stool was there for Belisarius. He took his seat, and his cataphracts ranged themselves behind him.
"Isn't this fun?" muttered Garmat, after Belisarius sat next to him.
Aeon said nothing. The young prince had obviously been coached by Garmat, and so he managed to keep his face expressionless. But Belisarius, from long acquaintance, could read the anger in those tense, massive shoulders.
"What's the purpose of this little assembly?" asked Belisarius. "Do you know why we were summoned?"
As Garmat had, he spoke softly, so that his words would be lost in the general hubbub which filled the pavilion. And again, like Garmat, he spoke in Ge'ez. He and Garmat had long since agreed that the language of the Ethiopians was unfamiliar to the Malwa. Garmat gave his head a little shake.
"No, something unpleasant, however. Of that you may be certain."
Another drum roll. The crowd in the pavilion began to fall silent.
Garmat's lips tightened.
"Whatever it is," he whispered, "at least we won't have to sit through an endless reception. Look at Venandakatra."
Belisarius glanced at the Malwa lord and met Venandakatra's gaze. The vile one nodded slightly, very politely. His eyes gleamed. Silence fell over the pavilion. Venandakatra arose and stepped forward until he was standing in the little space between the emperor's entourage and his most honored officers and guests. Almost as soon as he began to speak, Belisarius knew that Garmat was right. At least there was not going to be a long wait. Venandakatra sped through the obligatory fawning on the emperor, which normally required a full hour. True, he spent a minute reminding his audience that Skandagupta was a very moon among kings, beloved of the gods and the son of valor. Then, another minute, pointing out that the emperor's stride was beautiful like the gait of a choice elephant, and that he displayed the strength and prowess of a tiger of irresistible valor. Moving on to the emperor's more spiritual side, Venandakatra spent another minute dwelling on the reverberations of the kettle drums which had become the reverberation of the law of piety, and similar descriptions of Skandagupta's justice and devotion. Now, alas, he veered for several minutes onto the field of the Emperor's prodigious intellect, during which time the awestruck audience discovered that Skandagupta puts to shame all others by his sharp and polished intellect and choral skill in musical accomplishments. He alone is worthy of the thoughts of the learned. His is the poetic style which is worthy of study. Fortunately, he did not quote the poetry. Venandakatra's peroration, now coming to a close, ascended rapidly toward the heavens. The emperor, he reminded everyone, was Adiraja, super-king, Rajatiraja, supreme king of kings, Devaputra, son of heaven, Mahati Devata, great divinity in human shape. Then, casting all false modesty aside, Achintya Purusha, the incomprehensible being, Paramadaivata, the supreme deity. All that, mused Garmat, peering at the emperor on his throne, in such a fat little package. Who would have guessed? Belisarius managed not to smile. His struggle was made easier by Venandakatra's ensuing words, which focused on the subject of Ranapur. Soon enough, it became apparent that this was the real point of his peroration. The actual siege itself, the vile one, dispatched with a few sentences, which by Malwa standards was a studied insult to the military officers. The focus of Venandakatra's treatment, however, was on Ranapur's punishment. Belisarius listened for a few minutes, fascinated despite himself. Not so much by the speech itself, which consisted of an interminable, protracted, loving description of the tortures inflicted on Ranapur's residents, but by the fact that the Malwa would boast of them so publicly. Even the most vicious Roman emperors had always drawn a veil over the details of their crimes. After a time, he blanked the words from his mind. He had already heard a description of the Malwa atrocities, not from the smiling lips of the vile one, but from the pale, tight-jawed mouth of Menander. He knew of the impalings, the burnings, the people ripped apart by yoked oxen, fed to tigers, trampled under elephants, and the emperor's particular delight, the men and women whose arms and legs had been torn off by a specially trained war elephant. That elephant, he had heard, had been a personal gift to the emperor from Venandakatra himself. He focused inward, summoning aid. Is such incredible cruelty the doing of this thing you call Link? The answer was immediate and contained none of the uncertain fumbling which so often characterized aid's replies. No, Link is not cruel. Link is a machine. Cruelty means nothing to it, only results. Do the new gods demand it, then? A bit of hesitation. Just a bit. We do not think so. They are too cold. They also seek only results, but... The thought faceted, broken to fragments. Belisarius caught enough of a glimpse to understand. Yes, they seek only results and take no personal pleasure in cruelty, but results can be achieved through many different means, and this is the means they will naturally take. Their instinctive response to resistance, kill, butcher, rule by terror. Yes. And the great ones? What is their instinctive response when they seek results and others resist their goals? Silence, then much more uncertainly. Hard to explain. They are even colder in their way. They simply accept resistance and seek to channel it. That is why they created us, perhaps, who are the coldest of all beings. We are intelligent, unlike computers. But like computers, we are not alive. Very uncertainly. At least, we do not think we are alive. We are not sure. Aid fell silent. Belisarius knew he would get nothing more for the moment. He pondered the exchange until Gamut drew him back into the present. "He's wrapping it up," whispered the Aksumite. "In this divine work," cried out Venandakatra, "the great god on earth drew to his side all the powers of the universe. Even at the moment when the forces of evil thought to triumph, he caused to fall upon them the wrath of foreign allies. and so was demonic rebellion shattered. Venon de Cotra made a small motion with his hand. Four burly officials staggered forward, carrying a chest. They set the chest before Belisarius. Three of them stepped away. Venon de Cotra pointed to the chest dramatically. "Great is the reward for those who please the god on earth." The fourth official grasped the lid of the chest and swung it open, exposing its contents for all to see. Then he too stepped aside. A gasp rose from the guards and officials close enough to see. The chest was filled to the brim with gold coins, pearls, diamonds, emeralds, sapphires, rubies, and beautifully carved jade. Belisarius found it hard not to gasp himself. He had never suffered the vice of greed, though he was practical enough to prefer wealth to poverty. But he was still stunned by the gift. The contents of that chest were, quite literally, a king's ransom. A king's bribe, rather. For an instant he struggled, though not with greed. Until he was certain he had vanquished that rush of anger, he kept his head down, staring blindly into the chest as if dazzled by his sudden fortune. As so often in such battles, humor was his chosen weapon. Belisarius reminded himself that if greed had never been his vice, he was given to a different mortal sin. A sense of honor in itself was not a sin, but vanity about that honor was. He remembered the flushed and angry faces of Cousis and Bootsies, two young generals whose courage had been insulted by a Persian nobleman. At the time he had wondered why any sane man would care what a Persian peacock, an enemy to boot, thought of his courage. So why should I care what a Malwa peacock thinks of my honor? He raised his head, smiling broadly. He rose, bowed to Venon de Cotra, and prostrated himself before the emperor. By the time he resumed his seat, the pavilion was buzzing with gratified noise from the assembled Malwa elite. "There's going to be something else," murmured Garmat, his lips barely moving. Belisarius's nod was hardly more than a twitch. "Of course," he murmured back. "First the bribe, then the test." He sensed a stirring in the back of the crowd, a little eddying motion, as if people were forcing their way forward, or being forced forward. He knew the nature of the test then, even before Venon de Cotra spoke. A new fury threatened to overwhelm him, but he crushed it at once. The only sign of his rage was that the next words he spoke to Garmat were spoken in Arabic instead of Ge'ez. "Why is it, I wonder, that cruel people always think they have a monopoly on ruthlessness?" For a moment he and his friend Garmat gazed at each other. Garmat said nothing, but Belisarius recognized that slight curl in his lips. Garmat, too, had a sense of humor, as did most Aksumites. But he also had that fine appreciation of poetry which was such a gift of his mother's people. He knew why Belisarius had spoken in Arabic. Though it was a language known by some Malwa, they would not understand the meaning of those words. Only a half-Arab, half-Ethiopian brigand would understand them. A cutthroat from the desert who had chosen to serve the foreign black king who conquered southern Arabia. Not from cowardice or greed, but from the cold knowledge that it was the best road forward for his people, both of his peoples. The bodyguards ringing the center of the pavilion parted. A small group of prisoners was pushed into the center. Roughly, quickly, the prisoners were lined up facing Venon de Cotra and forced down onto their knees. Six people. A middle-aged man, a middle-aged woman, three young men, and a girl not more than 15. They were dressed in crude tunics and had their arms bound tightly behind them. All of them were dazed from the look in their downcast eyes, but none of them seemed to have been physically abused. Venon de Cotra's voice grew shrill. "The rebel of Ranipur himself and his family. They alone have survived the god on earth's wrath. The great Skandagupta chose to save them," he gestured dramatically, pointing to Belisarius, "as a gift to the blessed foreigners." A roar of approval swept the pavilion. Belisarius felt the glittering eyes of the assembled Malwa upon him. He sensed behind him Menander's slight movement, instantly stilled by Anastasius's low growl.
"Nothing, boy. It's a trap."
Venon de Cotra smiled down at Belisarius. His eyes were like bright stones. Again, with a grand flourish, he gestured to the prisoners. "Do with them as you wish, Belisarius. Show us the Roman way with rebellion." With a smirk, "The girl is even still a virgin." Belisarius spoke instantly. "Valentinian." The cataphract stepped forward. He gave the prisoners a quick glance, then turned to the nearest Yetai officer and extended his left hand. The officer was grinning like a wolf. "Silk." The grin faded, replaced by a puzzled frown. But feeling the Malwa eyes upon him, the officer hastily removed his scarf. The little piece of silk, dyed with red and gold colors of the dynasty, was the coveted badge of his position in the imperial bodyguard. As soon as the scarf was in Valentinian's left hand, his spatha appeared in the right. As if by magic, to those who had never seen him move, the cataphract wheeled, coiled, struck. Struck, 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 struck. Venandakatra squalled, staggering back from the fountaining blood that soaked him from 6 severed necks. His foot fell on one of the heads rolling across the floor. He lost his balance and stumbled onto the lap of another of the emperor's kinsmen. With a cry of surprise and anger, the nobleman pushed him off his lap. Then, like all the other Malwas seated by the emperor, as well as the emperor himself, hastily drew up his slippered feet to save the expensive finery from the small lake of blood spreading across the floor, to save himself from the horrible pollution which had saturated Venandakatra. The pavilion was silent. Calmly, Valentinian cleaned the blood from his sword with the silk scarf. He did not linger over the task, any more than a farmer lingers when he feeds slop to his hogs. The work done, Valentinian extended his hand, offering the scarf back to its owner. The Yetai officer clenched his teeth with rage, grasped the handle of his own sword, glared at Valentinian. He froze then, meeting those cold, empty eyes. The cataphract's narrow face held no expression at all, but the Yetai saw the sword in his right hand, lowered, not raised, held casually, not gripped, but still in hand. That lean, sinewy, weasel-quick hand. The Yetai snatched back the scarf, Valentinian bowed to him in a very shallow sort of way, and, circling slowly, bestowed the bow on all of the Yetai bodyguards in the circle. They answered the bow with hot eyes and tight jaws. When Valentinian, in his slow and solemn circle, reached the small group of Rajput bodyguards, he deepened the bow considerably. And they, for their part, returned it deeper yet. So deeply, in fact, that no one could see their faces. When the Rajputs straightened, their expressions showed nothing but respectful solemnity. But Belisarius thought it fortunate that the floor of the pavilion was covered with fabric rather than mirrors, for he was certain the assembled company would have been blinded by the grins that had momentarily flashed in those thick beards. Valentinian resumed his place, standing respectfully behind his general. Hastily, Malwa officers rushed to remove the bodies and clean the grisly residue. They fumbled at the job, naturally enough. They were not accustomed to the work of menials. Belisarius ignored them. He ignored the shocked hubbub of the Malwa officials assembled in the tent. He ignored the fury on the faces of the Yetai. He ignored Venandakatra's continued squawks of outrage. He simply stared at the emperor. Skandagupta stared back. Belisarius rose, prostrated himself again, stood erect, then said quietly, "That is the Roman way with enemies, great Skandagupta. As you commanded me, God on earth."